Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president gives a speech tonight about Afghanistan, except it's really about the economy. The chairman of the Federal Reserve gave a press conference today, actually about the economy. And our series, Economy 4.0, about the global economy. You see how that all hangs together there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 22nd of June today. And the president's speech on Afghanistan this evening is, in theory, a foreign policy address, but only if you figure that it involves troops overseas. The real motivations behind what the president is going to say tonight are mostly economic. Our Washington bureau chief, John Dimsdale, is here with a preview. Hey, John.
Hello, Kai.
So what's the president going to tell us tonight?
Well, he's going to say that the 100,000 U.S. troops who are now in Afghanistan have achieved some significant successes, and that's going to allow about 5,000 of them to come home by the end of this year. And the drawdown can continue into next year, adding up to about 33,000 by Election Day, which is the same size as the troop surge that President Obama ordered a year and a half ago.
All right. So if we know how much the surge costs, then can we interpolate how much this might save us?
We can very generally. It costs $1.2 million to keep one soldier in Afghanistan for a year. Mm-hmm. Now, you add that up, and it comes to about $12 billion in savings through next year. And that's pretty significant. But I checked in with Todd Harrison at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and he reminded me that there's going to be a lot of other lingering bills that will continue to come due.
In particular, I'm thinking of the cost of veterans' benefits and services, particularly soldiers who've been injured in the line of duty and are discharged from the military. They then qualify for veterans' health care, and those costs may not peak for another 30 or 40 years.
And also, you have to consider the costs of protecting some of those long-term construction projects that the U.S. Has started in Afghanistan. And those costs are going to be necessary even after all the troops have left in 2014.
Yeah. I'm going to pull out a phrase now, John, from, I guess, the end of the Cold War, right? The 1990s, 91, 92, peace dividend. Are we going to see any of that?
Right. Yeah, I remember that. We're not, really. And that's going to disappoint mayors and local officials who've had their eye on war savings to build some infrastructure here at home. Instead of building schools and bridges in Kandahar, they ask, how about a little something for Kansas City? Given all the hidden costs of this war, this drawdown isn't likely to mean a lot of job-creating construction projects here. Besides, you could argue that all the money spent in both Iraq and Afghanistan was borrowed anyway, and any savings, meager as they might be, should be saved for deficit reduction.
All right, John Dimsdale in Washington. The president speaks this evening at 8 o'clock Washington time. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Nobody's ever going to accuse Ben Bernanke of being a gripping public speaker. But then again, the chairman of the Fed didn't have much cheery news to relate today at his press conference.
The economic recovery appears to be proceeding at a moderate pace, though somewhat more slowly than the committee had expected. We expect the unemployment rate to continue to decline, but the pace of progress remains frustratingly slow.
This was Mr. Bernanke's second post-interest rate meeting news conference. It was also kind of a retirement party for the Fed's latest try at kickstarting the economy, what's technically called quantitative easing, usually shortened to QE2. The central bank's purchase of $600 billion worth of Treasury bonds is its second such effort since the recession began. It also goes away in about 8 more days, the end of June. So how'd it work? Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz has that story.
Last fall, the Fed's normal tools for juicing the economy were exhausted, so Bernanke pitched something like the Japanese had tried, buying up $600 billion of government treasury bonds. The idea was to raise their price, which lowers long-term interest rates and, in theory, causes more lending and borrowing. Economist John Canale at LPL Financial says the policy's legacy will be the disaster it averted.
Well, I think it helped to reinvigorate the economy at a time when there was a pronounced soft spot. I would probably agree with Bernanke and say that had they not done QE2, we'd be in much worse shape than we are today.
Canale points to a stock market rebound in the meantime, and today's modestly rising prices, a sign the policy met its goal of avoiding deflation. But Mike Englund of Action Economics says nobody could argue the economy is much better with unemployment at 9.1%. By spinning its wheels and seemingly fixing nothing, Englund says the main effect was to hurt the Fed's credibility.
The fact that the economic outcome was so poor, the perception effect probably was far more negative than any direct stimulus effect was positive.
Berkeley economist Brad DeLong says QE2 deserves credit as an interesting economic experiment. And that's about it.
It did kind of what we expected to do. It doesn't do very much for unemployment and growth, but then $600 billion was always an order of magnitude too small.
DeLong is one of those who'd like a more ambitious QE3 from the Federal Reserve. But as for the prospects, most economists do agree, don't bank on it. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Here's a guy with a better track record than Ben Bernanke has, mostly. John Paulson is his name, and back in 2003, he was pretty much a nobody. Now, it's a Wall Street legend, because he bet big that subprime mortgages would crash and gold would rise. He has made many, many billions of dollars being so prescient, but this month he took a huge hit on an investment he made in a company called Sinoforest. It is, as you might figure, a Chinese timber plantation company. And there were warnings along the way that Sinoforest wasn't what it seemed. And Paulson did sell all his shares, but it may have been too late. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains that even sophisticated investors sometimes aren't.
Masters of the universe, it turns out, have feet of clay. The talk of Wall Street right now is John Paulson's disastrous investment in Sinoforest, a Chinese timber company. If Paulson can lose on a bad investment, anyone can.
You cannot rely on other people to have your back.
That's Sal Arnuk. He runs a brokerage called Themis Trading. He argues that even sophisticated investors are often treated as patsies and fed unreliable information. He blames, in part, weak financial regulation.
Even great investors like Paulson have all jumped in and gotten burnt because we are in an environment where there's less protection.
Ironically, Paulson started out as the small guy in subprime mortgages, but he could do the research on them, and he got big. It's not as easy to do the research when the problems are in other countries, particularly countries like China, where capitalism is new and fraud rules are still weak. Here's Adam Bold, the CEO of the mutual fund store.
Clearly, in the less developed countries, you have much more opportunity for graft, for bribery, for whatever unethical practices are going on.
It's another reminder that power and status on Wall Street don't mean that an investor won't get the short end of the stick. What really matters is doing your homework. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, could have been worse given how depressing Ben Bernanke was. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The government of Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou survived a no-confidence vote last night. That means there's not going to be any real debt crisis news till next week sometime when Parliament's going to vote on tax increases and wage cuts as part of another austerity program. You could fairly say Greece has dominated the economic news in Europe and here to some degree, but commentator David Frum says we ought to look elsewhere for the answers.
While they riot in Greece, it's calm in Sweden. Well, that may sound like the ultimate dog bites man story. Isn't it always calm in Sweden? But wait a minute. We often hear that the Greece story is a story about excess government spending leading to social crisis. Yet who spends more than Sweden? In fact, in the decade leading up to the Great Recession, Greece spent about half its national income on government. That's high by American standards, but it's quite typical of Europe. Sweden ranks at the top of Europe's spenders. Sweden was hit extremely hard by the recession. The Swedish economy shrank more than 6%, one of the deepest slumps in Europe, and much more than Greece shrank at that time. but in 2010, Sweden started a strong recovery, while Greece has sunk ever deeper into the quagmire. What was the difference? Simple. The Swedes cut everybody's wages and consumption across the board. By cutting costs, Swedes boosted their exports. The economy surged ahead. How'd they do it? Simple again. Sweden has its own currency, the kroner. The Swedish kroner was one of the weakest currencies in the world through the recession. It lost more than one-third of its value against the dollar. Nasty and unpleasant for every Swede, but not the kind of nastiness that causes riots. The Greek drachma did not decline. For the powerful reason, there is no more Greek drachma, only the euro. So the Greeks have had to cut costs, company by company, government department by government department, person by person. The message here is not, the drachma rules. The drachma was a terrible currency, run by an irresponsible government. The message is, the right monetary policy can cushion external shocks. The wrong policy can transform a shock into a catastrophe. The United States has been hit by some very hard shocks. But despite zero inflation, some urge that the United States tighten its monetary policy to avoid, get this, going the way of Greece. Such people have their message exactly upside down. The medicine they prescribe is exactly the stuff that will bring the outcome they want to avoid.
Once upon a time, David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next week, Robert Reich in this slot. Your views, whenever you want to send them to us. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says Contact. French agriculture minister made some news today. He said the world could face a century of hunger unless there's better regulation of food supplies. There is, as it happens, a big meeting of farm and food officials in Paris this week, the first one of its kind. And there is, we're told, broad agreement that food prices are going up too fast and too many people in the world don't have enough food. There is not, however, much consensus on what the solution is. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Global food prices shot up by more than 15% in the last quarter of last year. The French blame excessive speculation and want curbs on it. Anne Pettifer of the Prime Economic Consultancy says the French have got a point.
The money just keeps pouring in on the grounds that this commodity has to keep rising into the future and we will make money in 10 years' time. And it's that volume of money going into the commodity markets which causes the problem.
But the Brits, with one of the world's biggest financial centres, will never go along with a crackdown on speculation. UK Farm Minister Caroline Spelman stands up for the commodity trader.
Farmers around the world use hedging to even out the high and low prices of their crops. And that is one way in which you're able to get a more stable price of food.
And, needless to say, commodity market analysts agree that speculation is not the main factor behind sharply rising farm prices. Erin Fitzpatrick of Rabobank in London blames more fundamental forces.
We've had weather disruptions in multiple countries around the world, which are major grain and oilseed producers and exporters. We've also seen strong rebound in demand.
There is widespread agreement at the G20 summit that countries should be more open about their own food supplies, but China and India are likely to balk at sharing more farm data. And the US won't be happy about this call from Oxfam's Duncan Green.
They have to do something about biofuels, where the rich country policies are taking food away from people and putting it into gas tanks.
40% of US corn is turned into ethanol. Duncan Green doubts that this first G20 Farm Ministers' Summit will make any difference to food prices. But it's a start, and he says, with an estimated 1 billion people around the world going to bed hungry tonight, the cost and supply of food will become an ever more pressing issue. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think we have a hunger inside us to really build something special in this country.
Entrepreneurship in the Emirates. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here's what happened. Stocks lost their footing today after the Fed stayed mum on any big new round of stimulus. The Dow Industrials unloaded about 80 points, two-thirds of 1%, 12,109 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ lightened up 18 points, also two-thirds of 1%, 2669 at the bell. The S&P 500 gave away 8 points also. Wait, was it? Oh, yeah, two-thirds of 1%, finished at 1287. Adobe Systems fell 6.25%. Quarterly profits jumped at the software maker, but its sales outlook was rocky. FedEx delivered an increase of 2.5%. The company's fourth-quarter earnings and revenue topped expectations. Rival UPS picked up about two-thirds of 1% today. CarMax revved up on a 7% gain today. The used car retailer reported good quarterly results. Why? The theory goes, buy a new car these days if you can buy a decent used one. The 10-year T-note held steady, the yield at 2.98%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for May. A Senate committee holds a hearing titled Stories from the Kitchen Table, How Middle-Class Families Are Struggling to Make Ends Meet. And the United Nations marks the first International Widows Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Our new media guy sends around a report every month about traffic to our website. And I am proud to say that in May, Marketplace.org got 100,000 unique visitors. All right, they didn't want to say. Hard as our web department might work, though, it's a little demoralizing when we read that Google had a cool billion individual visitors last month. The market research firm Comscore says that with its search page, Gmail, and YouTube, this is the first time that any web company's user base has hit 10 digits. Actually, the number was 1,009,699,000. And Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports these media-friendly milestones actually do make a difference.
A billion isn't as much as a Google, 10 to the 100th power, but it's still a number Google, the company, can brag about, says analyst Zias Caravalla at the Yankee Group.
Because it's approximately one-seventh of the world's population now. It's a pretty staggeringly large number.
And the fact that they're unique visitors, not the same people getting counted again and again every time they search, shows Google's incredibly broad reach. Still, not all web surfers are created equal, says Caravalla. Some stay around longer. Some do more stuff. Even though Google's ahead of Facebook in unique visitors, Facebook's users spend more time on its site.
While people go to Google to find things very quickly, they tend to leave Google fairly fast, where something like Facebook, they tend to know much more about you. They know who you are, who you hang out with, where you go, where you shop, what you like to eat.
And that's marketing gold for Facebook, says Gartner analyst Ray Valdez.
It's three of your friends purchased goods at Pottery Barn. Based on knowing certain things about you, they can target their message more precisely.
It took Google years to get to its first billion visitors. But with mobile devices in the mix now, analysts say the next billion is probably just around the corner. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Time to cue the music.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We went to Africa a couple of days ago for a story out of Mozambique, how the government there is cutting subsidies on basics like food and gasoline. Kevin Hall wrote from Seattle to point out that it's not just a problem that affects developing countries. Rich countries, he said, like the U.S., also give out subsidies and also have a hard time pulling back after the public comes to expect them. Think non-tolled freeways, he writes, non-taxed health care, child tax credits, mortgage interest credits, and so on. This wastes billions of dollars and creates enormous economic inefficiencies. President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner teed off together for a round of golf this past weekend. Our look at how political alliances are formed between the first and the 18th hole got this response from Yvette Yeskis of Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
No one voiced concern that when business decisions are made on the greens, people who should have a say in those decisions are absent. Women make up nearly half our nation's workforce, but only about a quarter of our golfers. They are incredibly underrepresented in our boardrooms. I don't think that this is a coincidence.
Finally, to our commentary the other day from Rob Walker on the trendy idea that failure is in itself an accomplishment. Catherine Nelson of Dixon, California writes that people who work with their hands know the meaning of unambiguous failure.
It seems to me that in a knowledge economy, many people have become either unable to distinguish between success and failure or unwilling to accept the possibility of unambiguous failure. And what intervenes in either case is a great deal of psychology and verbiage. Naturally, this presents a marketing opportunity. Failure seminars, anyone?
Here's some more verbiage. We want to hear from you. Send us your letters, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. A severe fuel shortage continues in the United Arab Emirates this week. Severe as in gas stations actually running dry. Kind of surprising, one could say, for a country that pumps 2.5 million barrels of oil every single day. Apparently it's refining capacity that they lack. The Emirates do pretty well, though, in terms of oil revenues, and that prosperity has given the UAE a cushion against some of the worst of the protests in the Middle East this past spring. But that cushion doesn't come without some discomfort. Our special correspondent David Brancaccio continues our series Economy 4.0 today from Abu Dhabi.
This is the new dish, and this is called laham magli. We need to do this one with lamb and also with camel.
Ali Salem Abdua is executive chef at Mezlai, said to be the only fine dining experience anywhere inspired by the native Emirates cuisine. For a citizen here, an Emirati, to become a chef just isn't done. This is the type of job Emiratis are embarrassed to get into, he says, as opposed to, say, a government desk job. One time, when Chef Ali was in training, he sliced onions dawn to dusk.
Chopping.
But he had to tell his mother, no, he was in an office just sipping coffee, so she wouldn't think he was slumming. This is one of the problems the Emirates government wants to fix in a hurry, getting UAE citizens into the private sector workforce and along the way encouraging Emiratis to get entrepreneurial. Fact is, educated people who feel unchallenged at a government desk job can get dangerously restless, which is something countries throughout the Gulf region worried about even before the Arab Spring. Most of the UAE private sector economy is staffed by the 4/5 of the population who are foreigners. The tried and true path for UAE citizens is the public sector.
That's where you get economic security.
Tariq Youssef is dean of the Dubai School of Government.
That's where you get the high salaries. That's where you get the incentives that ensure a high standard of living, along with job guarantees for life.
For Emirati workers, things aren't as secure in the private sector.
That's where you are forced to compete with expats. There are a lot of them. That's an open market. There is an unlimited supply of them.
And many of them are cheaper to employ.
Much cheaper to employ, much easier to hire, and much easier to fire.
One proposed antidote, the UAE government recently put up $120 million to use subsidies to boost what's called the Emiratization of the workforce. At this club in Dubai, 20-something Emirati guys chill with their water pipes, checking out a game on a buddy's smartphone. But life is not fulfilling for all. While the UAE's overall jobless rate last year was just over 4%, unemployment among Emiratis hit 14%, which is another argument for getting more people engaged with their country's economic future through private sector work, perhaps even by starting a business.
I think we have a hunger inside us to really build something special in this country.
This is the guy who's making it his sworn duty to get fellow Emiratis to take the plunge and invent new businesses of their own. Khalid Al-Amri has the charisma and the good looks of, say, a star ball player. He writes a column that often touches on entrepreneurship in the daily newspaper here, The National. First of all, he disputes a stereotype that Emiratis are like trust funders from Connecticut.
Look, I think it's a statement and it's a view that a lot of the West have of the Gulf countries. That, you know, if I go in my backyard and dig a hole, you know, oil will pump out. The reality of the matter is we live in a country that's quite competitive. The slackers aren't welcomed here.
He tells everyone he can find about what started as a government fund, now backed by private venture capital, that's given out $111 million so far in big startup loans to young Emirati entrepreneurs, interest-free. But more work is needed. Often around the Gulf, failure is taboo. You're disgraced if you try a business that doesn't work out. Also, bankruptcy laws here can make it a nightmare to wind down a venture. As for Khalid Al-Amri himself, he's not just talking entrepreneurship, he's doing, along with some Emirati pals.
Well, with these three friends, it started off as an idea. And the funny thing is when we travel to New York, when we travel to London, you look up at these concepts and you go, why don't we have that in Abu Dhabi? And it's the simplest thing.
They're proud of the venture capital they've raised, 90% of the money to launch convenience stores that replace junk food with something homegrown and organic. Think maybe 7-Eleven meets Whole Foods. In Abu Dhabi, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a glimpse at how, or perhaps where, the other half lives. I learned a new acronym today, HNWI, High Net Worth Individuals, people with a million or more in investable assets. Merrill Lynch and the consulting firm Capgemini did a survey. There are almost 11 million HNWI in the world today. That's up 8% from a year ago. More than half of them live in just three countries. So take a guess. What do you got? Come on. Okay, so the U.S. is one. Next? Yes, Japan. Okay, number three? Germany. So there you go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow unloaded about 80 points, two-thirds of 1%. The Nasdaq lightened up 18 points, also two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 gave away 8 points. Yeah, also two-thirds of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, Dubai's dueling economies.
They're a way to accelerate development, but ultimately successful free zones need to link back to the real economy.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.